In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. You direct, O Lord, all our actions by thy holy inspirations and carry them on by thy gracious assistance, so that every prayer and work of ours may begin from thee and by thee. Be happy in it through Christ our Lord. Amen. Our Lady of Divine Grace, pray for us. In the name of the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit, amen. What I'm going to talk about in this conference, tomorrow we're going to talk about Christian manhood and motherhood. The last time I was here, I talked about what it means to be, or how do you raise a man, but this next time I want to talk about what the role of the father and the mother is, particularly within the context of the Christian family. But for right now, I want to talk about the nine ways that you can become an accomplice or participate in someone else's sin. That is, they're doing something wrong and you can participate in it in nine ways. So it's kind of interesting because Thomas Aquinas, when he lists the nine ways, he just kind of does it as an afternote. And it's one of these things that after that, the whole moral tradition picked it up and started talking about it. But before we do that, I want to actually talk just a little bit about the nature of sin. So sin is a violation or an offense against the law of God. Now, what's the law of God? Well, Christ himself says, you know, the commandments, you know. So people will, today you'll hear people, even Christian people, who will be violating one of the Ten Commandments, but they'll just say, you know, I'm a good Christian, really? Yeah, I love Jesus. Okay, but why are you, why are you committing adultery, or why are you doing these other things? And they say, oh, yeah, I know, but I'm a good Christian. I'm really, well, okay, look. Christ said, if you love me, keep the commandments. And then in another place, the young man comes up to Christ and asks him, what do I have to do to be saved? And he says, well, you know the commandments. And he starts listing them off, and he starts listing the Ten Commandments. The young man says, yes, I've kept these for my whole childhood, right? So the point is that in order to be saved, as a Christian, we have to make sure we're following the Ten Commandments. We can't just by violating them whenever we feel like it. Because Christ himself says, if you're going to be saved, you have to be following the Ten Commandments. So anytime we violate one of the Ten Commandments, or one of the other precepts that Christ established, or that God established in the Old Testament, although you have to be careful with that because some of those were changed, because some people will say, well, Christ changed all that. No, he didn't. There were certain things which he left behind, and then there were certain in the Old Testament, and then there are certain things from the Old Testament he brought into the New Testament, and he says, this is the new and everlasting covenant. So this is the one that's in force now. The Old Testament is no longer in force, except for insofar as what Christ brought into it, and we know the Ten Commandments are part of that. Now, a sin, therefore, is a violation of the law of God, and sin, which means as a law, because God's the lawgiver, what's a law? Okay, well, a law is something that's promulgated by the person who has charge of a community, right? So that's one thing. It's something that they put out there. The second thing is it's an ordinance of reason. It directs us to specific kinds of activity. So when we're talking about a law of God, he's specifically saying, this is the law. You cannot do these things, or you must do these things. So not all the Ten Commandments are negative. Some are positive, like, honor your mother and your father is a positive thing. We must do these things. And if Christ is to be believed, that you have to do these things in order to be saved, there's certain things you must do in order to be saved, so according to, if you put it together. Okay. So, that being the case, then a law is anything that goes against those laws, if he has a sin, is anything that goes against those laws. The law is a specific directive that he's given to us. This is what is to be done. This is what's not to be done. And then, of course, there are if you violate the law, then there are certain punishments due to the law. And so this is why Christ, he talks about how, it's better to pluck out your eye than end up in hell, basically, over the whole thing. The point being is that there are certain sins that can actually end us up in hell, and we have to be very careful about it. Now, there's two parts to every sin, though. The first is the subjective part. And by subjective, we mean that this is how voluntary did the person really know what they were doing when they actually did it. So this is primarily in our will, where we make the choice either to do God's will or not to do his God's will, or to follow his law or not to follow his law. And so for a long period of time, the theologians said that sin is in the will, because that's where you choose to violate his law or not. Okay, but in order to choose something, we actually have to know what we're doing, right? So if you don't know what you're doing, the will doesn't really fully grasp it, because it's a blind faculty. It can't think on its own. That's what the intellect is for. And so if we don't know in the intellect what's truly sinful and what's not, then we may not be committing the sin with full volition, and so there might be a mitigation of our responsibility or culpability. We see this even in the judicial system, when it's working properly in the United States, where if we recognize that someone, you know, who might be responsible for someone's death, if we realize that he had no intention of killing the person and that he didn't really understand what was going on, then we tend to reduce the sentence because we realize, okay, he shouldn't be punished as much as the guy who fully intends it and calculates it and thinks about doing it. But then there are certain objective effects of sin. So the subjective side or the objective effect of sin is that when we choose something in our will, it disorders our will because our will can be habituated. We see this with people who have virtue. People who have virtue are in the habit of choosing the right thing in relationship to that particular virtue, like temperance or justice or things of that sort. Whereas a person who's sinful gets into the habits, they end up with vices, but they get into habits of choosing things that are bad, and that habit inclines them to doing things that are bad. So each time we commit a sin, it builds up in the will an inclination to do something contrary to what is God's law. Okay, so that's one of the effective effects, or subjective effects of sin. When we make the choice, it builds up the vices, it inclines us to doing things that are wrong. But then there are objective effects, and by objective effects we mean it doesn't matter whether you thought you were doing the right thing or not, this is what's going to happen as a result of it. So, for example, if I think that I'm particularly fond of midgets, so I decide that I want to have midgets enjoy the experience of flying. And so I'm standing on the top of this building, throwing midgets off the top of the building. Look at how fun they think it's really fun. Look at them going down it, right? Okay. Now, the problem is that even though I think I'm helping them out by helping them to learn how to fly, the problem is death is going to occur. It's an objective effect of what I'm doing. So you can have an activity, an action, which has very specific kind of effects that arise from it. So throwing people off the top of a building is going to end up with people getting hurt, whether you realize what you're doing is wrong or not. And the same thing is true of all the sins that we commit. There's certain objective effects of our sin that can cause disorders. You know, it's like the people, I'm sure you've seen this, everyone keeps talking about it. You know, they're playing the game Charlie, right? Mm-hmm. Where they ask Charlie, you know, they summon Charlie in order to come and give them answers. They may think it's kind of cool and it's really interesting, and they may not even think that they're violating the first commandment, but the fact of the matter is that it's an open door to demons getting involved, and as a result, the demons can start affecting people through that process. And so that's an objective sin. It doesn't matter what you think it is or not. You're summoning the guy. You know, it's like standing outside yelling somebody's name, thinking that, you know, you're clearing your throat. That may be the case, but the fact of the matter is that if the guy's name is Mark and you're yelling out Mark, you know, he's going to clear your throat. Mark's going to come running, right? So this is something that's really important, because today people tend to think, oh, well, I didn't intend to do this. It's not my fault this thing happened. Well, that may be in the sense of that you didn't formally sin, but then the fact of the matter is that it doesn't matter that the fact is that there's certain things that are just going to follow from that kind of behavior. Okay, so this is something that's really important, that even if people don't think they're committing the sin, there's still the objective effects that are occurring. This is not just in relationship to us. This is in relationship to other people, too. You can cause damage in other people's lives by the objective effect of your sin, regardless of where you are at up here. You can still cause damage. So, for example, you know, it doesn't matter if you don't think that you're committing any sin by, say, you know, beating your children. Although maybe we should talk a little bit more about that. Okay. It doesn't matter if you don't think that you don't think you're committing a sin in beating your children. The fact of the matter is that it leaves them with psychological effects as a result of the objective effect of the sin. So even if you didn't intend it, it doesn't mean, therefore, that you're, you know, that it didn't happen or that there's not these objective effects. This also means that sometimes we have to kind of clean up the mess a little bit from our objective, the objective effects, the damage we've caused, like, for instance, in our family relationships or in things of this sort. If we've done those things, we have an obligation to kind of clean up the mess because of the fact that, well, I may not have been culpable for it, not realized it, nevertheless, I should be the one to clean it up in order to restore the order that God had intended in relationship to our family relationships and things of this sort. Okay, this is where then becoming accomplice to someone else's sin kind of comes in. So we can participate in other people's sin, and as a result there can be kind of objective effects of sin. Like one of them we're going to talk about is by silence. If you don't say anything under certain circumstances, we're going to talk when you're supposed to and when you're not, but if you don't say something to correct somebody, and as a result someone else gets hurt, then you're responsible for that person getting hurt if you see it and you could have stopped it, right? Today, people just have this attitude, well, I didn't, you know, it wasn't my job, it wasn't my responsibility. Well, maybe, but the fact of the matter is that when you saw it and you knew the guy was going to run over, you know, the little kid running in the street, you should have said, whoa, whoa, slow down because there's some guy in the street. Okay. All right. So what are those nine ways? The first is by counsel. Now, by counsel, we mean that you give advice, you tell someone or suggest to them that they should do something which they ought not to do. You know, and this is kind of becoming more and more common. So one of the things that you'll tend to see in relationship to counsel is people will, you know, very common. I once did this homily where I made the observation that, you know, there's something disordered in a culture when smoking and having a beer or drinking is a mortal sin or grave sin, but fornication is actually a virtue, right? So one of the things that's happening today is people will say, don't get married until you try it out first. No. First of all, you don't need to try it out. That's actually what the courting process is all about, is to find out if the person has sufficient virtue. You don't need to test the equipment, so to speak, in order to know whether it's going to work or not. God's got that already figured out. Don't worry about it. All right. So this is one of the things people very often are counseling. Another thing that people are often counseling is counseling people to do things that might be financially advantageous to them, but in point in fact are harmful to the common good. So we're seeing that a lot, like in our own political system and things of this sort. Okay. The next is by command. This is when you tell somebody that you have authority over to do something that you know is in fact bad. So, and this one, you see, for example, you know, one of the big historical cases is the fact that a lot of the people in Nazi Germany, a lot of the people in charge of Nazi Germany were commanding people to do things that people knew better. They should have said, no, I'm not going to do it. Some did, but a majority just followed the commands. But this means that the person who gives the command, if they tell them to do something immoral, they're also responsible not just for the telling of the person that, but they're also responsible for what comes as a result of it. Because of the fact that they know, as part of the objective part of the sin, if I tell this person to go and shoot this guy, well, the guy's going to end up dead. So I can't be saying, well, I just told him to shoot it. He didn't have to. You know, I'm not responsible for the fact that he shot them. Well, actually, you are, because you're also responsible for the effects that flow from the things that you do that are disordered. The next is by consent. This one is This is when someone tells us that they're going to do something or asks for permission, and we give consent to them doing it. Say, yeah, that's okay. I don't have any problem with you doing that. And this is this has become a this has also become a big problem as of late, because of the fact that we often, parents will give consent to their kids doing things that they, the parents themselves, when they grew up, were taught better and knew that you just don't do these things. And so the kids will try and go and get consent from the parents. Parents have to be really careful about that, that they don't give consent to things that the kids want to do. You know, one of the things, I'm going to apply it to children, but I originally said it in relationship to husband and relationship to his wife. So one time this guy bought this house, and the house ended up having some very severe problems with it. And originally, his wife and him used to live in the country, and they loved living in the country. But she saw this house, and she really liked it, so she wanted it, because they had to move anyway, because they were moving to a different part of the country. So he bought this house indoors, and I said, in town, and I said, you know, you really shouldn't have done that. You should have waited and bought a house outside of town. And he says, well, my wife wanted it. And I said, so? And he says, well, isn't it permissible to please your wife? I said, oh, yeah. I said, but there's a general principle. You violated the golden rule. He says, what's that? You never give your wife what she wants. Ever. Ever. What you do is you give her what you know will make her happy. If she's a virtuous woman, those are one and the same thing. If she's not a virtuous woman, those aren't one and the same thing. But what ended up happening was, is that his wife, 3 weeks later, was miserable living in town. I'm like, see, that's why you don't give her what she wants. You don't know what's going to give her, what's going to make her happy. And those are two distinct things. Because the goal for the husband is to achieve the happiness, not just his own, but his wife's happiness as well. And this is something which he kind of violated by just kind of giving into what she wanted. So by consent, he ended up with a bad situation. It's the same thing with children. You never give children what they want. They're all looking over me, like, why does he have to say this? You never give children. You give them what you know is going to make them happy. What's going to make them happy? That which is in accord with virtue, according to Aristotle and the whole moral tradition after him, that we get a semblance of happiness just by leading a good moral life. And so that's what you ultimately have to do in relationship to children. Okay. So parents have to be careful not to give consent. On the other hand, kids today are obnoxious. Well, I suppose they've always been, but to some degree. But what they'll do is they'll want something. They'll go to the parents. And if the parents don't give it, then they do this thing called triangulation. Then they go to the other parent and try and pit the parents against each other in order to try and get what they actually want. So, that being the case, that triangulation is not following the right order. It's actually sinful. Because it's not honoring your parents. But the other thing that sometimes kids will do is kids will go into a bad situation. The time I see it the most is in a bad marriage. You know, they're in a bad relationship. They decide they want to get married, and so they, you know, they want to marry this person. The parents know this is a bad situation. They know it's going to end up in divorce. They know 2 or 3 years down the road they're going to hate each other and be split up. And so the parents will say, look, I don't think this is a good idea, or I don't want to come to your marriage because I think this, and this is, you know, you're in the end it's not going to be good. And then the kids will put the parents on a guilt trip by saying something to them to the effect of, you're not being charitable. This is against charity. If you really loved me, you would come to this thing. No, if I really loved you, I would tell you, don't be stupid. That's what I would tell you. So this is something that you get the kids are trying to get the parents to give consent to something that they know is bad. Part of the reason you also don't give consent to something that's bad is because then in the process there's a loss of authority in the process. If the kids know, hey, you know, if you ask or you pester mom enough, eventually she'll say yes to something. Or if you do this to dad, eventually he'll say yes. When in point of fact, what you're doing is you're conceding authority to them, and that's going to, later down the road when you have to tell them no to something, they're just going to switch into that mode of trying to get the consent from you. The next is by provocation. Provocation. This is basically when you press the person's buttons, right? So you basically do something which you know is going to make the person angry, or which you know is going to hurt the person so that they'll react and, you know, emotionally and things of this sort, rather than trying to get them to do what's ultimately right. Now, I don't mean to be beating up on the kids, but this just seems to work really well here. Okay. Kids know just the right buttons to send the parents over the edge. And so they'll go around pressing it, pressing the buttons, and then, you know, the parents get mad, etc. Provocation is also, though, not just with parents, it can also be between spouses, where they say things that they know is going to hurt the person, is going to get them angry. But this provocation is something that really destroys charity, because you don't end up, you know, it's not, if you really loved God and you loved your neighbor for God's sake, you wouldn't be going around poking people to trying to get some type of negative reaction out of them. Okay. It also manifests ill will. When you're poking at somebody to get, and here I'm not talking about just joking, but here we're talking about provocating them to sin by pushing them or to getting them to react in a certain way, then it shows a sign of ill will, because you're not really looking out for what's best for the person. You just want to get the reaction out of them. Provocation can also be just setting up a set of circumstances so that somebody caves or does something that they normally wouldn't do. Okay. The next is by praise. Oops. By praise or flattery. Now, basically what this means is someone does something wrong, and so you tell them, that was good. You're really good at that. You know, you're really good at throwing midgets off the buildings. Right? So it just seems so effortless to you, right? Okay. So what this is, the real problem with this is that one is you're confirming the person in their disorder and their sin. The second thing is that you're playing upon their pride and their vanity, which is also a sin. So that you're basically compounding the sin and making it, you're basically weakening the person, making it harder for them to do the right thing. We also know, because we know that, well, if we say the right thing, it'll inflame the person's pride, and so that we're more likely also sometimes to get that out of them. And this is a real problem. You know, one of the lines that you see in Scripture a lot, when the Jews would go talk to Christ, he would say to them, they would say to him, we know you're not a respecter of persons. And that has a very specific meaning, that phrase, you're not a respecter of persons. It basically means that Christ, or God, is only interested in what is true and what is good. He's not interested in what people think. What the Jews were basically telling is they can already recognize in Christ, he's not interested in what people think. He's really only interested in salvation. How do you save these people? But he's also, which means he's interested in the truth, which is and also the good. That's what he's looking for. So this is something that's really important, because it means that when we cause people to sin by praise or by flattery, we're playing upon their human respect. That as human beings, especially after Adam and Eve ate the fruit, what happened is now we're prone to, as human beings, accepting praise and wanting other people to think well of us. That's just human respect. It's human respect in the sense of we are respecting the person's opinion of us above and more than it actually should be. In other words, who should we really follow? God. We shouldn't care what other people think. It shouldn't matter, as long as we're doing the right thing. And I'm not suggesting go around teaching people terribly or just ignoring them or not trying to lead them along and find out where they stand intellectually so you can kind of lead them along to the truth. What I'm saying here is that ultimately we shouldn't care what people think. We should just be willing to do what is right, and it shouldn't matter ultimately. And so when we do this praise by flattery, we're inflaming in people that human respect, which weakens them so that it's harder for them to stick to the truth. Because when we suffer from human respect, when we have human respect, where we look to other people's, we overestimate people's opinion of ourselves, or it becomes more important than the reality of it should be, then what ends up happening is that when that happens, it's harder for us to do the right thing. And this is one of the reasons why we have to be careful not to do this. You know, when Cain killed Abel, God asked, where's your brother? He's like, am I my brother's keeper? Yeah, you actually are. And that's what part of this is all about, is making sure that you're not contributing to your brother's demise. Okay. The next is by concealing the evil done. By concealment. This is when someone's done something bad and you hide it. Okay. So, I suppose in the modern political system, this one's going on quite a bit. There's a lot of bad things that are happening, and they're keeping it from the people. So let's just say, for example, an example of this. Let's just say there was a president in the 1980s who wanted to commit adultery. And he decided, or sorry, in the 1990s, he wanted to commit adultery. And so what he did is he arranged it through other people, and he made sure that they would cover up for him in case there was any question in relationship to it. Okay, that the people who conceal it are guilty of the sin of concealment. So this is something that a lot of people tend not to... Not, it doesn't mean that you have to go around broadcasting it. It just means that you don't hide the injustice. For example, if that were the case, his wife has a right to know that this has happened because he's violated. He's violated the fidelity that's required in marriage, and so if they can, if she says, if she comes to the, she discovers it, and says, "Hey, you know, was my husband out, you know, violating the sixth commandment?" And the people who helped him said, "No, he wasn't dead. He was just over with us having a beer." Sorry, it doesn't work that way. Okay. Another one is where you partake in his sin. Sorry, this is number six. Number seven is to partake. And partake means the person's committing the sin and you join in with them and the actual committing of the sin. So, a very classic example is people will start gossiping. Someone brings up, "Did you see what Bessie Sue did last night?" "Yes, I saw what she did. But you know why she did that?" And then the next thing you know, the two are two, and then the next thing there's three people, four people, they're all talking about Bessie Sue's bad behavior, right? They're participating in the person's gossip. And that's why they just have to stop it. Okay, so you just don't want to do that. And this partaking can be in any kind, not just gossip, it can be any kind of sin that can be involved. Okay, the next is by silence. Now, with silence, this can occur in several ways. For instance, someone is about to do something wrong, and we fail to give them counsel or to correct them. Now, we're going to talk a little bit about when you're supposed to correct people and when you're not, but the main thing is that we see someone's about to do something wrong, and we don't do anything to clue them in. So, for example, you know, you see one of the guys riding a tractor and he's about to mow over the prize goat. Of course, for me, I'm just thinking, does that mean we get lamb chops tonight? No, anyway. But he's about to run over the prize goat and you see it and you just don't say anything. You just let him run it over. Well, that's participating in sin, or that's, you know, you're an accomplice to the person's sin by silence. This is something that, again, we'll talk about when you correct people and when you don't. Another way is when someone speaks in favor of something evil or ungodly and we don't say anything. This is a very common problem among Christians, especially in our current ambiance where there's so much attack now on every element of Christianity, everything from the Christian view of marriage to what is sinful, what's not, etc. That's all under great attack, and a lot of people will just stand there and say nothing when the people are attacking it. And so we have to be sensitive to the fact that we don't want to commit the sin of omission where we just fail to defend Christ. So that doesn't mean that you don't be rash, you know, and launch off into something that you're not prepared to defend. That means, like, if you can't say anything because you can't rebut them properly, well, then you go and you study so that you can come back and say, "Hey, look, this is really the story." But it also means that we have an obligation to sometimes correct people or say no, or at least stop their argument. I don't see any problem with that kind of marriage as long as the two people love each other. Well, you know, love is not the foundation of marriage. It's the law of God is the foundation of marriage. It's how God structured the thing and designed it. It's called the natural law. That's the foundation of marriage. Not that the people love each other. I'm not suggesting you shouldn't love each other in marriage. That's not what I'm saying. I'm just saying love is not the love is not the foundation or the reason for why people should get married, the sole reason. I think it should be there. I don't think it's the sole reason. So correcting people. So what do you do when, you know, when somebody says something that's wrong or somebody does something that's wrong? Okay. This is part of what St. Thomas calls fraternal correction. When do you correct your neighbor? What are the principles that govern it? Because we all know there was a school of theology that said you should correct everybody all the time. It was a Franciscan school. The problem with that is you're annoying and people are going to stop listening to you. It's just basically the issue. So the other side of it is, too, is that in the end it becomes counterproductive because you try and, if you keep correcting people all the time, then what happens is people just give up. You know, in Scripture, in the Old Testament, it says, fathers, do not nag your children, lest they lose heart. What that means is don't be constantly correcting them. Don't be constantly on top of them. Okay, so when do you and when don't you is the real question. Because if you do it too much, it's counterproductive. If you don't do it, well, you could be failing in your obligations before God to help people. Because we are our brother's keeper. Okay. So when you're going to fraternity correction is stopping somebody and explaining to them what they're doing is wrong and how they shouldn't be doing that. That's essentially what it is. You're correcting them. Okay. The first thing is that you must have knowledge of what's really going on. Don't just step into a situation, you don't have a clue what's going on, and then you barge in and start correcting people when you don't even know what has happened. Okay? Because, first of all, it's a sin against justice because you're not taking due diligence and making sure you actually know what's going on. And two, it's against justice to these other people because you're not giving them a fair shake because the thing may not be at all what they actually think it is. So you have to be careful with that. So you have to know what's actually going on. Second, you should do it out of charity. What does that mean? You're not doing it to hammer people. You're not doing it in order to make sure that people do exactly what you want all the time, right? In my book, in psychology, I talk about, there's a chapter just labeled control. I'll talk a little bit about more of that tomorrow. But there's a chapter called control, and basically that chapter I talk about how people who control other people, it's a sign that their own interior life is out of control because they can't refrain their emotions in relationship to other people, so they want to control them to get it under control because they can't, they don't have that, they're not stayed interiorly, they're not controlling things interiorly. This is actually true, that's totally true. I mean, you look at certain politicians in that are currently in the street, they want to control every little single facet of everybody's lives, but it's clear that they have absolutely no control of themselves. It's just clear, right? So that's one of the signs. But it should be done out of charity, which means you're doing it for the love of God and for this person's spiritual well-being, and that's it. No other reason. You know, a lot of times, and you have to be really careful because I talked about it the last time I was here in the context of perfectionism, where people will do it out of a desire that externals are perfect rather than making sure their own interior life is perfect first. So we get a certain satisfaction out of everything being very done, very orderly. That's true. But you have to be able to curb that appetite for that. You have to temper that with virtue. That is, with the virtue of temperance or with the virtue of justice or what have you, so that you're not seeking after controlling the thing externally to you to its detriment. Okay. So, and this is one of the things I think that is really important in relationship to parents and relationship to children. You have to be careful not to try and control them. I have seen families where that actually happens. And then what happens is the men will reach 19 years of age and they literally cannot function on their own. And so they can't hold a job down. They can't, with any kind of semblance of consistency, they can't. They're not in any position to assume the essential obligations of marriage because they can't even take care of themselves because they're constantly being told what to do. So that is a bad sign. Which brings me back to a point which I made last time, which seems to be being misunderstood a little bit. When I talked about, with children, between the ages of when the time they're born until the time that they're six, basically, during that time, kids don't have full use of reason. So you just have to tell them what to do. You don't reason with them. You're wasting time, It always gets me when these people sit down with this kid who's 2 years old and say, "Now, Johnny, you shouldn't hit her. Wouldn't you feel bad if somebody hit you?" All the kid wants to do is grab the club and whack the parent now, right? So it's just counterproductive. You just have to, and this is why Aristotle says, the way you raise children between this age is by pleasure and pain. You associate good behavior with rewards, which you have to do, because the opposite is always people who just never reward their kid or never praise them or never say anything good about what they do. But the opposite is you have to associate pain with the things you do. So you smack their hands when they hit other people, and then they make that association, and then they'll stop. It's interesting because psychologists are beginning to realize that association, that process of building up those associations with good behavior with reward and bad behavior things, is the primary foundation of all moral training. They're finding out that if kids don't get that by the time they're six, after that, it's over. You're never going to get the person to the point where they're really doing the right thing consistently. They just realize that, and that's one of the things that's actually happening. Okay, from 6 to 10, of course, they're all, at this stage, you're still under obedience. Which means if your parents tell you to do something, and you don't do it, it's sinful. Okay, so obey your parents. At this stage, you can start reasoning with a kid, right? You can start saying, well, look, this is why you do it. This is what you're going to do, and this is why you're going to do it, right? And so this is what you do during that stage. During the stage when they finally get through puberty, or 10, sometimes it depends on the child, 12, 13, 14, depends on the kid. Between there and then, the child is still bound by obedience. So if your parents say, do it, you can't sit there and argue with them. You can't sit there and reason it out. You can't say, well, this really should be a time for counsel. No, this is a time you obey. Okay. However, it's also during this time that the parents do need to start counseling the child so that the child can start making the decisions and he can prove to him that he's mature enough to do these things on his own. So you don't have to constantly be telling him what to do. After the age of 18, until you're dead, you're not bound under strict obedience to your parents, but you're still bound to do their moral bidding unless there's sufficient reason to the contrary as a matter of fulfilling the commandment of honor your parents. But it also means that that if you live in their house and you're eating their food after you reach the age of 18, because that's all your parents' obligation is to get you to the age of 18. That's it. After that, they have no more obligations, strictly speaking. Now, that doesn't mean that charity wouldn't say that you just kick them out, but it just means that after that, if you live in their home, you're also bound under obedience if your parents set the rules down, because they have a right, especially the father, to make the determinations of how the household is going to be properly ordered. And so if you go against that, you're violating his rights and his authority, and that's a sin against justice. Okay, so even though at this stage, the parents, if you're living outside the house, it's to be counsel, that doesn't mean that if you're living in the house, you can just do that, you're not bound by obedience in relationship to what their legitimate commands are in running in their home. Okay. That being said, the question then is charity. Charity has to dominate in the sense that your goal is the spiritual well-being of the person, and it's not to club the person over the head. Most people, in their correcting, especially when they're correcting their children, they're not looking at what's the best for my kid here spiritually. They're just really irritated that Johnny is acting up again in public, right? So they whack him out of anger or things of this sort, which is disorder, because it shouldn't be that way. You should only, and by the way, I'm a fan of corporal punishment, but it has to be moderated, right? It has to be rightly ordered. And it has to be, you know, there's two parts to the corporal punishment. The first is the child has to have done something really wrong, right? So you just spank the kid, and, you know, because, well, what did I do? Nothing, you know, okay. Because then the kid, it short circuits, because kids have a natural inclination to learn what's morally right and wrong from that. And if you're just spanking them for no reason whatsoever, what's morally right and wrong seems kind of capricious or just, you know, it's random. It doesn't make any sense about what is and what isn't. This is why kids can end up very messed up in abusive homes. But then the other side of it is that it should be proportionate and moderated so that the kid knows, you know, I actually spent the milk because I wasn't paying attention at the dinner table. You don't take the kid out and, you know, give him 50 lashings with the cat of nine tails, which is that one whip that they whipped Christ with, right? You don't do that, right? Because it's disproportionate. The kid's like, I don't understand why this is happening to me, right? So you have to be very careful. There's one question St. Thomas says, can you corporally punish your son, like by spanking him, if he's never done anything wrong? And St. Thomas says, no, and he lays those two things out. He says, unless the kid is just completely undisciplined, then he says you may have to get him straightened out. But what that's a sign of is that something wasn't done at this stage, right? So if you're having to do that, then you've got a different kind of a problem, usually. Okay. So it has to be done in charity. It has to be done for the person's spiritual benefit, which means because it's going to be done for the person's spiritual benefit, it has to be governed by supernatural prudence. What is supernatural prudence? Well, first of all, what's prudence? Then we'll talk about the supernatural part of it. Prudence is the virtue in which you know the right thing to attain the right end. I know what to do at the right circumstances in order to achieve the right end. Okay, that's the nature of prudence. Some people who know what the right thing is to do but act contrary to that, they're imprudent. They're acting imprudently. Right? Okay, what is supernatural? The end, so prudence is about means or activity that we do to achieve a particular end. Supernatural prudence, the end, is God. What do I have to do to save my soul? What do I have to do to help this person save their soul? What do I have to do to get this person to, to do the things that God wants them to do, what's better for them spiritually, because what's spiritually for them is that they reach God, ultimately, and conform their lives so that they can actually reach God. Okay. That's what actually has to be taken into consideration. Now, the problem, okay, so prudence is taking, what is prudence? So it's an activity, knowing the right activity to reach the right end. But Thomas Aquinas says that prudence is taking the universal principle and then you apply it in the concrete. By concrete, he means in the circumstances, in real life situations. Okay, so what are the universal principles? Well, it's the Ten Commandments. You know, thou shalt honor thy mother and thy father. Or, part of the Ten Commandments, too, is as you see as it plays out in the Old Testament, is that parents are supposed to take due, part of the Fourth Commandment is that parents are supposed to take due care of their children. So they know they're supposed to take proper care of their children. They have to apply it in the concrete circumstances. And St. Thomas says, how do you go from knowing this universal principle down to actually doing the right thing? And he says, this is based upon past memories. In other words, you look at what's worked in the past, and that knowing the different kinds of things that have happened in the past will tell you that's how you actually are supposed to apply it now. So what happens is that when we see that, for example, if you have a child who, like I know this one guy, he's got this 3-year-old kid. If you saw him, you'd like, he is the consummate little boy, right? He's a little man. You know, he's awesome. And the problem is he can take a pretty good beating and it doesn't faze him at all, right? I mean, you can smack him and everything like that and he's just like, he's not going to, you know. He's like, man, he's a tough kid, right? So that's counterproductive. I mean, you're not going to get into the point, you're not going to beat him to the point where the kid is just literally physically bruised up and you're not going to do that. So what are you going to do? Well, you got to find some other method, right? And so you're going to have to figure out, okay, so given this, then what we need to do is, you know, take the things from him that he wants, or other things that will make him so that he has to rethink about what he's doing. So you have to adjust it based upon the individual circumstances. Now here's the thing. In order to do that, go to past memories. This is done by thinking about them. That is, we have them in our imagination. Now, the real problem is that our imagination is affected by our emotions. And St. Thomas says something very interesting. He says the emotions, when they get into the imagination, makes things appear as if they're worse than they are or better than they actually are. So that when it comes time to apply this principle in the concrete, you know, for example, okay, Johnny should be spanked, all right, but I'm like super angry. And so the tendency of anger is to go to extreme in your reactions, that's the nature of it, and so what you end up doing is you end up spanking him harder than he should be. This is why you have to clear your head, and this is one of the reasons why you have to make sure that your emotional life is rightly ordered and that you're not following your emotions in relationship to this. Okay, so when we're acting out of charity, if we're going to act truly out of charity, we can't be acting out of emotion. We have to be, if we're going to act according to supernatural prudence, we have to act upon what is the best for this person in this particular individual's circumstance. You know, that means, of course, that you're not going to correct them every single time, because human beings have a certain threshold psychologically. You keep after me and eventually I'm just going to tune you out. Whereas if you just correct me at the times when I know I need the correction, or when it's, you know, salutary for me or for what's necessary, then what ends up happening is the person, if they have any semblance of virtue, will say, yeah, okay, I'm glad you said something because otherwise I would have forgotten or what have you. But if you're constantly correcting the person, then eventually the person's just going to tune them out. That was that whole line from the Old Testament. That's what that's all about. So you'll know when to correct and how to correct based upon supernatural prudence. Now that becomes a little dicey, as we'll see. You have to, which is this next principle. When you look at somebody, you have to make a reasonable judgment that they will take the correction. In other words, if you go to them and you say, by the way, Father, throwing midgets off the building is actually a form of murder, and it's not a good idea that you actually do that. And I'm just enjoying myself thoroughly, right? And you know I tend to be an angry individual when I get denied the things that I want. I'm checking these midgets off, and you come up and say, Father, stop, you shouldn't be doing that. What's going to happen? Father's going to get mad at you, and he's not going to take the correction. Okay. Although if I was throwing midgets off and he told me not to do it, I probably would take the correction. Okay. The point being is that you have to look to see if the person's even going to listen to you. Because here's the thing. The correction is to correct the person's path so that they can become closer to God. If you try to correct them and you make a reasonable judgment, they are not going to take the correction. In fact, it's going to make the situation worse. It's just going to confirm them in their sin. Then you are responsible for that confirmation, and you are responsible for their worse condition. So you have to be very careful about that. And that's where the real dicey part becomes is, well, sometimes you don't really know. You don't know if I tell this person, stop throwing midgets off the building. You don't know if they're going to take the correction or not. And so I tell people, okay, well, if that's the case, then you have to kind of approach things indirectly at first sometimes. So you have to ask them, something like, do you think killing people is a good idea? Without talking about throwing midgets off, right? Later you can apply it to the midgets. But if the guy says, yeah, it's really bad, then maybe you shouldn't throw midgets off. Okay, so in other words, sometimes you can test the waters a little bit at the first, talking about something that's only indirectly connected to see what the person's response is, to know if that's going to be, if you're going to actually get the proper response or not. And then from there you can go to try and figure out, okay, then you can correct them. But if you know that if I tell this person, stop doing X, he's just going to get really angry and it's going to make him never listen to me or listen to me even less, then you need to do one thing. You need to pray that God gives them the grace so that they can see the truth about the matter and will change. Okay. The next is you have to avoid hypocrisy in this process. Don't be guilty of the thing that you're going to correct. Now, that doesn't mean if you have, you've committed in the past, you can't correct people, because you can legitimately say, look, I used to do that, don't do it. You don't want to light your cigarette off in the munitions dump, right? You don't want to just sit there and smoke in the munitions dump. Because I tried that once, and that's why I only have half my limbs. All right. Okay, the point being is that you can correct somebody. If you've changed your life and you've recognized what's wrong, that's okay. But you can't change them if you haven't changed your life, because people will just write you off as a hypocrite and that you don't really believe what you think. When correcting those people who are above us, it has to be done with two virtues in mind. The first is humility, so that it does not come off as, you know, you're correcting somebody and standing above them when you're not. You're actually, you submit to them. The second thing, which is the one that most people end up violating. This is the one I see violated the most in relationship to children correcting their parents. They tend to lack any kind of semblance of humility. The second one is piety. Now, piety is where you have honor for those who are above you. In other words, you still have to treat the parents or who's ever above you with a with the respect that's due to them, which we talked about last time. We talked about piety. The questions then become, do I have to correct people, you know, all the time? We've said no. But there are some kinds of times of correction that bind more than others. So if you see me throwing midgets off of a building, because I'd like to see them fly, then that's a pretty grave situation. It's serious. And so you have the people around me have a more serious obligation to correct me. In other words, you got to stop all these midgets flying off of the building. It's creating work for the people down, cleaning things up down below. No. The point is that you're killing people when you're talking about sins that are really serious. Your obligation is more than to say the sin is, you know, if you see some guy use a little bit of vulgarity here or there, or who, you know, people start gossiping, you don't have to correct them every single time. In fact, one of the moralists asks the question, do I have to correct people who are only committing these slight sins, you know, all the time? And he says, no, because if that was the case, you'd be correcting everybody all the time. So you have to just kind of watch for when is a good opportune moment to just say, hey, you know, maybe you shouldn't use vulgarity here, you know. Or maybe you should just, you know, one time there was this one woman who I really like her. She's a neighbor to one of my relatives. And she would use the phrase, oh my God, all the time, all the time. And it was, obviously, it's profanity because she's using God's name vainly. So one time I said to her, I just said, you know, if you took the name, if you took the word God out of your vocabulary, you'd be speechless. She didn't even realize she was doing it. And so at that, because I realized she's a good woman. You know, she's trying to lead a good Christian life. She wants to do the right thing. And so I realized I can correct her under the circumstance and get her to stop that. She actually stopped. Within a year, she was completely free of it. She really worked on it. So you have to look to see, okay, will the person take the correction with minor faults? St. Thomas asked the question, do parents have to correct the minor faults of their children? They said yes. He said yes, they do, because that's necessary for their moral formation. But it should be measured and not constant, he said. So, but when it comes to other people, we don't necessarily have to correct them all the time, because if we do, it's going to make it worse. Okay. The last one we want to talk about in relationship to sins that people can commit, being an accomplice to other people's sin, is by defense of the ill done, by defending the person or the ill that is done. This is the disease of certain parents. That's what I've found. In other words, the kid is doing something bad, and one of the parents wants to correct the kid. The other parent is saying, you know, no, there's nothing wrong with what he did. That's okay. There's nothing, you know, seriously out of order with that. Why, you know, why? No, okay. First of all, defending it is basically confirming the kid in his disorder. The second thing is that it's not helping him to get corrected. Now, that doesn't mean that, therefore, you keep correcting the kid or constantly correcting him because he's just going to end up with bigger problems, right? So, but on the other hand, you can't defend the bad thing that they have actually done. So, and this is really important, not just in relationship to our family life, but it's also important in relationship to everything, you know, in our society, in our culture, worldwide, is the fact that you have all sorts of people defending stuff that's just evil. Look, if it's evil, let's just admit it, that it's evil. I'm not gonna impugn any necessarily sin to the guy who did it because he may not have recognized it at the time, but that doesn't mean we still go around defending it. Because if we defend it, then we're participating in the person's sin to some degree. Okay. Any questions? Is that Scruffy sleeping or is that someone else? Yes. Well, you know, I think that the thing that's the most important is, you know, in prudence, it's knowing the right thing to achieve the right end. I find that in discussing that particular topic, it's really all about laying the intellectual groundwork. So, in other words, talking about contraception is going to go absolutely nowhere unless people have a good understanding of the natural law. The natural law states that God designed human beings in a very specific way with a very distinct structure in all of his faculties. And so we know what God's will is in relationship to those things based upon how he structured it. So if we act contrary to that, we're going against his will. You have to first start out with that. Then you have to go into the structure and the nature of the conjugal act and how it's intrinsically ordered to children. And then from there you can discuss, and therefore you don't have contraception. So some of it's the how you do it. The other part is, the one time that I gave a long homily on contraception, I actually spent 3 weeks beforehand laying out the entire natural law. Because otherwise, you end up, you know, because of the fact that practically everybody's doing it, even the Catholics. Plus, you've got the problem of the people just say, well, it seems reasonable. I mean, you know, I don't want to have children right now. Why don't I just do it? So they have to actually understand the natural law properly. And then the structure of the generative faculties, which is what we have children through, before they're really going to grasp, you know, why this is okay and why it's not. So, I don't know if that particular thing does that, but if it doesn't, you're going to have to get the, with anybody in a relationship with a number of things, you're going to have to get them to sign off first on the natural law first, before you go down that path. And that has to do with the right thing. So, interestingly is that, I'll just leave it at that. So that's, I think that's the real question. Because I think, did I talk about the different kinds of law last time? Maybe not. When you're talking about God in relationship to law, there's actually different kinds. The first is the natural law. Well, what's the natural law? The natural law is we know what God intended human beings to do, because he designed our faculties to do those things. So, for example, we know that part of the natural law is that you should only tell the truth. Why? Because the intellect in a human being is designed to know the truth. Our faculty of speech is designed to convey what's in the intellect. And as a result of that, if we don't do that, there's this, we're violating the nature of the faculty of speech, which is to convey what's in the intellect. And the intellect is to know the truth. So it's not until people understand that, you know, God designed the natural law, and he created us in a very specific way. Remember when I said a law is a promulgated ordinance of reason? So it's promulgated? Promulgated. There we go. St. Thomas says, what's the promulgation? Where did God tell us this is what the natural law is? He says, in the very creation of human nature. You look at human nature and you just know going around and lying a lot is going to be deleterious to not only your own intellectual thing, because eventually people get into the habits where they can't tell the truth from reality. It's called mental illness. We know that that's not helpful. But it's also, it's going to cause damage to relationships. It's going to cause damage to the culture and the society. I mean, you see that all the time. I mean, you know, when it comes to the news media, you have to wade through three quarters of what they say to get to any semblance of what's probably really happening. Because they're literally making this stuff up as they go along. But the point is that this promulgation of the natural law is not just about our intellect and our wills and about our emotions. It's also about all facets and aspects of us as human beings. So this is one way that God determined. If God didn't want us behaving that way, he would have made us differently. But he didn't. He wanted us behaving. In fact, what most people don't know is that the Ten Commandments are purely a writing out or explication of the natural law. If you look at the way human beings are designed to function, you can literally line it out based upon, we know that we have a natural inclination to worship and to love God. We know that. That's part of the first commandment. We also know we have to avoid evil things, which is stay away from demons and don't worship them. We also know that we have to treat God with respect. That's why you don't say things contrary to his name. We know we have a natural inclination to worship him, and that's why there's the third commandment. The fourth commandment is we know we have a natural inclination to obeying our parents. You see this with kids. I watch it. It's a marvel all the time. Kids will obey their parents even when the kids know the parents are, you know, don't have their best well-being out from the kids. There's an intrinsic ordering in the child to obey the parents, right? It's the same thing with theft. You know, we have a natural inclination to kill. So let's start with that one. So we have a natural inclination to not kill people because we know we don't want to be killed ourselves and we know it's harmful to society. We have a natural inclination to know that you don't commit adultery because it causes so much damage in society and in relationships. We know we have a natural inclination to not steal. Why? Because we want to own our own property. We don't want people stealing it, right? And we know that the ownership of property is necessary for the raising of families in order to be able to have a stable family life and things of this sort. We know that we're not called, you know, to lie or to covet our neighbor's goods. Why don't you want to covet? Because if you start coveting it, then you're going to disorder your interior faculties. Eventually, you start stealing from the guy, right? So we know on the Ten Commandments, you can literally, St. Thomas Aquinas does it. There's a book called the Summa Contra Gentiles. There's one book in there where he takes the natural law and he argues to every one of the precepts of the Ten Commandments and shows this is part of the natural law. Okay, so there's the natural law. Then the second one is what's called divine positive law. These are the laws that God came down and gave to us. So when Christ said, they asked him, what's the greatest of the law? And he says, love your neighbor, or love God with your whole heart, your whole mind, your whole soul, right? So the precepts of charity are part of the divine positive law. We have an obligation to do so. So this is something which is important because this means that when God comes and tells us what the laws are in scriptures, where you usually see them, what those laws are, then that's what we're supposed to follow because he's told us. This is the divine positive law. But the natural law, much of the divine positive law is just a making clear to man what the natural law is. Not all of it, but much of it. So these are what we're actually supposed to follow. Then the real question becomes is, what about civil law? And this has become a question which philosophers have discussed for a long period of time, whether we're bound in conscience to follow the civil law, whether God is, you know, whether God promulgates the civil law. Well, obviously he doesn't promulgate it directly like these two. However, any authority that they have, it's kind of interesting because no two men, if you take a look at two men, one man, just by looking at the fact that they're men, putting aside any other consideration, one man does not have the right to bind another man in conscience. He doesn't have that right, just considered under itself. Therefore, in order to have that right where one man binds another man in conscience, he has to receive that right to bind another man in conscience from the person who does have that right to bind men in conscience, and that's God. So St. Paul says it, the Catholic Church has repeatedly said it, all authority comes from God, which means you have an obligation to follow the civil law as long as it's not sinful. Now, the problem is that the people who are promulgating the civil laws now are promulgating things that are sinful or completely incapable of being fulfilled. I mean, when Bill Clinton left office, first of all, I think they're laws. You can call them executive orders, but I'm sorry, they're laws. If you don't follow them, you go to jail or you get fined, which is the same thing as a law. It has the same effect as a law. The guy put out 100,000 pages of executive orders. Well, excuse me, but the fact of the matter is that you keep changing the law, you keep piling on top of it, and people are just, it's going to destroy the effect that civil law has in the minds of people. You know, 50, 60 years ago, people knew you were supposed to obey the law. Today, people don't have that any idea whatsoever. Why? Because Congress is constantly changing stuff, adding laws. It's impossible. Even the people at the IRS admit that the IRS code is so complicated that the people at the IRS don't even know what it means or what it's supposed to be. Well, okay, then you got a problem here. But the point is that we, you should follow the civil law as a way of being obedient to the authority that God has given them. And this is what I always tell people. I'll talk a little bit about it more tomorrow. This is what I always tell children. You know, you obey your parents, not because it's your parents, but because of the fact that they've received the authority from God to tell you this is what you have to do. Okay. Any other questions? You can come back for me. I'm not talking about it anymore.
What is the eternal law?
Oh, yeah. Well, okay. So the eternal law is the law, the natural law and the divine positive law as it exists in the mind of God. So God has these things in his mind about the right order, and then he makes them, he puts them into concrete promulgation or practice by putting them into the divine positive law and the natural law. We don't have direct access to the eternal law except insofar as we see what he's done here. Okay. Yes.
The natural law pertains to science and the minutiae that science deals with and the changes that science is making in biology, specifically. I mean, we're getting some pretty muddy water about what is.
Yeah, well, the fact that you can now have three parents to a child, they're genetically modifying all those things, right? They're doing all these things. Genetically modification actually in animals and plants is a little bit more complicated of a thing because it's only immoral indirectly, not directly. Mm-hmm. However, genetically modifying, you know, babies and wombs and things like that. Now here, if they had some way to, you know, once the child reaches a certain age, to give them some kind of drug that would change the DNA code that pertains to the problem, that's one thing. But when they're basically, you know, taking genes from this kid and that kid, or from this parent and that parent and this parent, and then they're putting them together, that's not at all how God had intended it to be done. I mean, if he intended that, there would have been some mechanism to do that. So, the natural law, too, is very often misunderstood because there's a distinction. When you're talking about law and nature, There's a distinction between physical laws, you know, the fact that things tend to tend to gravitate towards a center of mass doesn't mean, and that's a law, doesn't in a sense that it's a law in the sense that it's something that happens very consistently all the time, and God has designed it that way. Doesn't mean if I take a rock and I throw it up in the air and acting contrary to that somehow or another I'm violating God's moral law, which is different, of course, than by nature we're talking about here. We're talking about God's moral law as it pertains primarily to human beings. So,
a question back on, how you can participate in another's sin.
Yeah.
The other question of enabling a situation that's sinful.
Yes.
And that can, there's all kind of ways. For instance, some charities maybe, support sinful things, some.
Right.
Others.
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways you can.
Yeah, that's actually done, indirectly. So, for example, if, one of the common thing that we're starting to see is gay marriage. Well, if you're going to give money to make it possible for these guys to live together, that's actually, which of the nine does that fall under, do you think?
Where you have silence, which is another thing.
Well, it can be silence that you're not saying anything. But it's also by consent, and it's also by counsel, because by giving the money, it's a form of counsel. Because the way we direct people sometimes is how we pay them.
Yeah, that's right. So then you're actually violating a couple of them.
Yeah. Which is one of the real difficulties. So, okay. Yes.
So if you shop somewhere that promotes gay marriage in their, Costco or...
I think that's a different... Yeah, that's a little
it's
bit...
It's very difficult.
Well, there's a bit of a different quality. I mean, if you can find companies that don't promote it, mm-hmm. then you should probably go with those companies, but you have to also realize... So, generally speaking, you should do that just as a matter to kind of... for me, it's more of a promoting the people who are trying to do the good lives as opposed to, mm-hmm. taking away from the people doing the bad. I'm just more interested in, let's just promote the stuff that's good. The problem with that is, and it's the same thing, you should be boycotting all these companies that promote abortion, all these companies that are, doing this, that, and everything. Well, if that was the case, first of all, you would have to spend a disproportionate amount of time finding out who's doing what, and a lot of times you wouldn't find out. The second thing is that you'd find out that you probably couldn't function hardly in our culture. You couldn't even, you couldn't buy a Ford, you couldn't buy a Chevy, you couldn't buy, go down the whole litany. All these people are supporting this stuff. So, or food, yeah. So you have to be, you can't follow that as some kind of a principle. One of the things that I mentioned, I'll just mention this because somebody's probably kind of wondering about this. GMOs, the reason why the GMOs are against the natural law is not because of the organism that's being changed. It's against the natural law because the genetically modified stuff affects human beings in a deleterious way. And so that's why it's immoral. It's not because somehow or another we're being, say Scruffy, we genetically modified him so he'd be really big and tough and muscular. Okay. It's not against Scruffy. It's against all the people who are going to go get bitten by the guy, right? Well, it's the same thing in relationship to the food and things of this sort. When companies come in and massively change this stuff, a lot of times they don't know the effects, which is contrary to prudence. It's against justice. They argue substantial equivalence. Sorry, not buying it. The second thing, and also the fact that it affects people's health deleteriously, and they're only now finding out how this stuff, which is very different from the genetic modifications that they used to make historically. If you look at God built in mechanisms to genetically modify stuff naturally. You breed certain things with certain specific animals with certain specific traits, etc., or plants, or what have you, in order to get a desired outcome. And so it was built into the nature that God, because it came from the way God structured it, it was naturally going to have in it all the things that were going to preserve us so we didn't get hurt by the thing. It's not the case when you start chopping it and slicing it up. So that's one of the reasons why you have to be careful because of the effect it has on people. Benedicta Deo omnipotentis Patris et Filii et Spiritus Sanctus, super vos et mani et semper. Amen.